Welcome back, everyone, to the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 13. The RCR is a show about computing history and nostalgia by a group of computer historians, hobbyists, and collectors. I'm Earl Evans, and I'm your host today. I'm in Portland, Oregon, where it's currently sunny with some clouds, and in the 70s, it's beautiful weather here. Don't want to gloat, but it is gorgeous. I'm also the host of the RetroBits podcast. Next, we have Carrington.
Oh, sorry. Do I do it that way?
It's your turn.
That's your cue.
Never misses a cue.
I didn't know that's how we do this. Oh, my goodness. I guess it's been a while. This is Carrington Vanston from Toronto, Canada. I am host of the 1 Megahertz podcast, but Apple IIs, and also host of a movie review podcast called Double Take.
Yay.
And next we have is what we're doing now.
Well, actually, we
I'm your fan.
Talk about Double the take. Weather.
Hello.
Hello.
All right, you guys. Simmer down. We usually talk about the weather, but
that's
you're in a
right.
different place.
That's okay. I can talk about other weather. It is sunny and beautiful in Toronto, I hear, but I am down in Kansas City, Missouri right now, and it is stinking hot, like crazy, crazy hot here right now.
Is that one of the places that's been hit by this heat wave that everybody's
yes.
talking about?
It is the epicenter of it. It must be. The gates to hell themselves have opened up. It is – we're mostly inside one set of buildings, but when we have to walk across to another one, just that tiny short walk is enough to just completely overheat me. I can't believe how hot it is here.
Wow. Well, for us crazy Americans with that weird Fahrenheit stuff, what would you say the temperature is?
7 billion, which is roughly 45 Celsius.
Awesome.
Yeah, I round in Fahrenheit.
And we also have David Grealish.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, introduce yourself, David.
Oh, I hail from Johns Creek, Georgia. And speaking of the weather, it's... that heat wave is here as well. It's all over the greater southeast. I don't know if Missouri's part of this. Is it part of the south? I'm from Florida originally, but I don't think I've quite felt it the way it's been just lately, where the humidity must be over 100%. And it's like the most, what's the word people use? Sticky, but it's muggy. Is that the word?
Muggy,
I mean, it's ridiculous. Mm. It's literally like a full-on sauna. And then it was like that earlier, and then we got this thunderstorm that just went through here just a little while ago. Thankfully, it's gone now at the time of our recording. I've lived in many different places, Florida, Virginia, Texas, lived in Germany a couple of years in the military, and I have never heard thunder strikes as loud as it happens here in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area. I mean, they are loud. I swear they're like two houses down or something every time.
But, yeah, I'm glad your power's still on.
Yeah, it flickered one time right when we first got on the call together, Earl, and then now it's fine.
Good.
So I read the Stan Veets History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast and sometimes do a classic computing video podcast.
Cool. But mostly just cower from
under. Hide under the bed.
Podcasting from under his bed in Georgia.
But yeah, the weather that we're experiencing... And you are currently Carrington. I think it's supposed to be like all through the weekend too. So yeah.
I choose to believe that this is what it's like in America all the time. I will soon go home to Canada and
it's a steam bath.
Yes.
Well, most of the time people are making fun of Portland for the weather, the rainy, cloudy all the time. But I got to say, we're sitting pretty right now. So I'm going to gloat a little bit about that. And then I'm going to move us to talk to the items of interest. So, and we hope that you find them interesting. I think they're interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So first up, who has this one? The homebrew CPU. Is that yours, Carrington?
No, it's not.
No, it was something I put in.
I think that's a David throwdown.
That was your David?
Yeah. It was something being discussed on the March, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, their email and list forum or whatever. And I know I had seen it because the guy didn't just make it or whatever, so I know I had seen it sometime in the past. But it is so interesting and so unique and cool, I just thought it'd be worth mentioning and putting a link up in the show notes. So basically the guy, Let's see, what is his name? You know, I should have read this ahead of time. It's called the, anyway, it's called the Magic One. It's a home-built mini computer.
Ooh, and, I've seen this before. This is really cool.
And the really interesting thing about it, too, is it does not use a microprocessor. So it's completely homebrew. The person absolutely built the whole thing. So even the CPU is hand-built from 74 series TTL chips.
Microprocessors were a fad. They've come and they've gone. From now on, it's all going to be macrame.
I mean, it's just so good looking and just so, you know, it's just such a beautiful machine of blinking lights and switches.
You know, that's the thing that I was so impressed with the first time I saw this. This person built such an immaculate looking front panel. I mean, it's, you know, reminiscent of Altair or IMSI or whatever with the rocker switches and all this blinking lights, like you say, is just gorgeous.
And I guess it would be, you know, it would, and he's calling it a mini computer, so it would be related to like a PDP-8 or, you know, obviously a discrete circuitry mini computer versus, you know, a microcomputer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, just worth mentioning, you know, the links in the show notes, lots of information here. The guy answers a lot of great questions, a lot of good links and stuff. So
did you happen to notice if there was a video of this computer in action? Because, I mean, it's cool to look at the picture, but it'd be really cool to see all those LEDs doing their stuff.
Wow, he's got a super high resolution of the picture, too. But
yeah, if you click on it, it's massive. It's gorgeous. I totally agree. Like, the front of this, I mean, I don't know if it's sacrilege to say so, but frankly, I think it looks nicer than an original Altair. I think this thing is absolutely stunning.
And I'm looking. I don't see, you know, I just see there's a photo gallery, but I don't see anything. Yeah, there is a video. If you go to the photo gallery, there is a video. Poor video, but here is Magic One running in the new enclosure. Oh, a couple of videos. Oh, he's got some... I guess some earlier ones where it was, you know, ugly.
Fear the bandwidth constraints here at Rockhurst University, so I think I will skip the videos for now just in case.
Oh, well, you got to check this out, though, when you have it. Everybody needs to check this out.
Me.
All these pictures, and then the pictures, way more pictures in the picture area. Just amazing.
Well, now that I tell you I can't click on stuff, you can say, oh, way more pictures. And look, it's made of gold and chocolate, and they're giving it away.
Well, you know what the guy did where you don't see that in that initial picture is...
But they only give it away if you watch the video.
He has like a blue light in there, and he actually has like a little window in the top of it so you can look down into it.
I choose to believe that that's not true. I'm gonna ask our listeners to ignore all this and to not go to that link.
So, yeah, that is a gorgeous computer. So I haven't seen the videos either. I'm going to go look after this.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's going to go look at the videos.
Yeah, well, you can, too. You got your university Wi-Fi there going. I'm sure you got like 2 terabits or something.
No, I don't know about that. It's our ping rate here is crazy slow, and every once in a while when you try to open something new, it wants you to re-authenticate, and then it just shuts down anything you have going. So I'm not touching the net till we're done with this call.
Yeah, it's not friendly, but. You know, since we're on that topic, why don't you tell us about it?
I was going to say, what do the professionals call this? A segue, I think?
It is. Yeah.
How would any of us know what the professionals call it? So I guess that does segue into why I am sitting in Kansas City, Missouri, in a dorm room at Rockhurst University. I am attending Kansas Fest for the second time ever. It's an Apple II gathering that happens annually. Always around this time. I think it's always been a July event.
Never heard
this
of it.
This is something like its 20th year or something. It's been going on for ages and ages, or maybe 19, but, you know, ages and ages. There's about 40 to 50 people, I think, attending. One of the nice things about it, the last few years, the attendance has been shrinking. This year, though, it's up to the highest it has been in quite some time. And the bigger deal is, there's 8 or so, or maybe I think 6 to 8 people attending for their very first time. But I think the big deal is that there were 7 new attendees last year, and all 7 of them are back this year. So that's the kind of thing that really helps you build a community, which is nice. And that's what this event sort of all is. It's the one time a year where Apple II people get together, and whether they can attend or not, this is launch season for the Apple II. So when there's new products or software, new hardware builds, new whatever, when there's big announcements, they all happen either at Kansas Fest or concurrent with Kansas Fest. So this is the the most exciting time for us Apple II fans of the year. So I'm delighted to be here. It's been absolutely amazing so far. There's still a couple of days to go. It runs Tuesday through Sunday, and I've had a complete blast. It is just, they call it Summer Camp for Geeks, and it's a very apt description. I was speaking with a fellow named Stavros, who is a frequent attendee. He's been coming, I think, since 2006 or so. He was telling me he was here the year that I attended the first time, back in 2007. And he was saying he's a medical doctor. And he says what he likes about coming to Kansas Fest is that it's like going back to university for a week, but only the really good bits. It's all the fun of university minus the class and the homework. So all it is the socializing and the fun and the late nights and the food and the exploring and research, and but just on things you're interested in. So it sort of distills the university experience down to only the good bits.
That's kind of an interesting in itself. Yeah. That's a very interesting angle of the whole thing too, really.
And that's what it is. We stay in a university dorm. You can either get a roommate or get a single. I normally get a roommate because it's fun to interact with somebody more long-term while you're here. And it's just all about, you know, eating together and gathering in common areas and sitting in the hallway till 2 in the morning talking about hacking ideas and going over each other's code and hardware and that kind of stuff. And just there isn't an experience like this. I think even in the other retro computing events, and there's lots of them that happen throughout the calendar year, I don't know another one that's like this, where you all get together and live together for five days and stay up to 2 in the morning and get involved in each other's projects and really completely live the vintage computer experience at such a level for so many hours straight.
I think that is unique. I think you're right. I don't think there is anything else like that, and it sounds really cool.
There's definitely nothing in that wimpy Commodore world.
Easy now.
I wonder if this year, you know, mentioning that the turnout is bigger than ever, mm-hmm. I wonder if this might represent a turning point. And I'm trying to think how I want to say this, because I don't intend any derogatory intent whatsoever.
Bring it.
Where it's been a thing of like, you know, well, we're the diehard Apple II fans and we love it, and some people, you know, or the reality might be, look, you know, hey, give it up already, you know, geez, the time, you know, it's not getting any newer. Apple II is going to just die away finally one day, and there won't be a Kansas Fest. Versus, it's reached a threshold of now other people are starting to think of it more of a nostalgic, you know what I'm trying to say,
mm-hmm.
as a legitimate.
Thing,
a classic car or something.
I have three responses to that, and they are the following.
The first show.
Are you going to give us? are they in chronological order, alphabetical?
No, they're in order of whim.
The second one you'll do in a little girl's voice.
It seems that I do them all in that.
David, this is Carrington. Don't go there, man.
The first is, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I attended Kansas Fest the first time back in 2007. It had been on my, what they now call a bucket list, but what I have on the net is just the list of things to do before I die, because I'm not afraid of the morbid stuff. And for a number of years, I had wanted to attend, because I had heard about this event, you know, more than a decade before I attended, and I always wanted to go, and I set aside the time, and I made sure I went, because honestly, I thought it was 2007. How much longer can this event go? I know it's getting smaller. Like, I'm really into the Apple II, but there's no way there can be that many people. This was before any I think I had just started, I guess, podcasting, but I hadn't been doing it very long. And I really wasn't that aware of what kind of a community there was. And I figured, well, if I don't come this year, there might not be one next year. So I totally understand the thinking behind that. At this year's event, it's nice that it is an event that seems to be growing, and it has sponsors, and it's it definitely seems to be on an uptick, but who knows how these things go. One of the early sessions, because there's informal gatherings that happen, you know, 24/7 while we're here, but there's also actually on the schedule sessions. So like every few hours, there'll be something during the day to say, you know, here's a talk about this, or somebody's giving a presentation on a new piece of hardware, or there's going to be a new product release from Syndicom. So come down at 3 o'clock, and there's a main sort of meeting area that's in a theater sort of style. And we'll gather down there and people give presentations. And what's nice is it's the attendees. So it's the people that come here. Most of them will volunteer and do a session. So they have their 1 hour that they present to the group. It's like a little TED talk that way. But anyway, one of the earliest sessions, in fact, the first or second, they were talking about the attendance and Kansas Fest in general, and it was a community-based session. And they did have everybody, because there was almost everybody there, they had us all stand up very, very quickly, introduce ourselves, and then say, you know, what we're into, like, are we a hardware developer? Are we a hobbyist? Like, why are we here? And a very quick sentence, you know, what got us into the Apple II. And what was interesting was a number of people had said, you know, a good, you know, sixth of the people here got into the Apple II very recently, and they really weren't diehard Apple II users. It's not really a nostalgia thing. Like, maybe they touched a bit as a kid. It's more that they've gotten interested into 8-bit computing, and this is the platform that they find most interesting. And at least one fellow stood up who was really interested in it. He's never owned an Apple II in his life, or never even really used one. And it was just in the last year, it seemed really interesting. He liked the sort of products that were coming out, and he's just sort of getting into it now. And this is his first exposure to the Apple II. So who knows? And a good half of the people here really do skew towards, you know, what we'll call much younger than Carrington. So me
being the
advisor
of
the world. Yeah.
I was going to ask about the age, because a lot of the emails that I get on RetroBits, I'd say a decent percentage are people who, you know, I've had them from 14, 18, 22, 24-year-old, you know, people who weren't even around or were, you know, toddling around in diapers when these computers came out. And they're into the computers now, and I don't know if it's part of the retro craze or if it's just that these machines are approachable and it's kind of, you know, fun to play with them, and it's still fun even though they're older. But I was going to ask you about the demographic there.
It skews a bit older than, say, average. And it, I mean, a good half of the people here are definitely in 30s and up, 30s, 40s, and onward, right up to, there's a person here about to celebrate their 96th birthday. We all signed a card.
Wow.
In fact, a couple of, we signed two cards, that one that said,
he was,
you know,
he's an attendee.
It's just, yep, it's a she.
Sorry,
two different cards. It was those, you know, congratulations, you're 75. Another one because the two cards added up to 96 because there aren't cards that go that high. So we've had to combine a few. So she'll get two cards. Yeah, but there's a number of people here that definitely are, you know, 20s. I think the youngest was 23 because I was at a lunch table at one point because we all eat together all the time. And one of the gals here is 25, and we thought, oh, is she the youngest? But there was two other people in that long table we were at that both were younger than her. They were both 22 or 24 or something. But I would say it skews a little older, partly probably because it takes a certain amount of, you know, money and time and wherewithal to be able to take a week and swing down here. It's not necessarily something you can do if you're in your teens.
True.
Oh, and the third point, I did say I had three. I actually do have three, was that there was a session. One of the sessions was on the golden age of the Apple II. So it was they had three different panelists discussing what did people consider the golden age of the Apple II? Why was it that? And also, is there a chance for a resurgence of, not necessarily that, you know, Apple's going to start putting them out, not that sort of idea, but more, you know, what is the nature of a vintage computer and its importance now, and where might we go with this sort of thing? And are people seeing a resurgence in interest in not just the Apple II, but 8-bit computing in general? And so it was something that was actually a topic of discussion here for quite some time that day. And it was an interesting panel. Like, for instance, to give you a feel of the sort of thing that goes on here, on that panel were Bob Bishop, who I don't know if you guys know, but, you know, was Apple employee, big software developer, been around for ages and ages and ages, you know, a guy who really was part of the creation of the golden age of the Apple II, and is just an attendee at the event. There was Dr. Stephen Weirich, who you guys probably, he does the Apple II history site and scans things and is actually my roommate here at Kansas Fest this year. And Jeff Weiss, who is one of the people that puts out Juiced.gs, the still ongoing Apple IIgs magazine. So the three of them were the panel, sort of coming at it from different ages and different experiences, and they took questions from the audience and stuff. So it's a really interesting panel where we discussed this exact sort of thing.
Now, do you, like you say, the audience, do you have like visitors too?
Not really. It's really only the people
just
that come
the
here.
The attendees. Okay.
Yeah. So if there's three people in the panel, there's 37 of us watching.
Right.
It's the same group. Not everybody goes to every panel. People that come here, you're not obligated to do anything. More than half the people that come here don't give a talk or do a panel. There's no reason why you have to. If you don't feel comfortable talking in front of people, there's never any pressure to do that. Or if you don't, think you have something to contribute, though obviously everybody does have something to say, even if it's just your own experiences. We have a lot of very personal panels versus ones that are releasing software. But it really is just the attendees that come here and you go to some panels and you do some talks or just hang out in the hallway or what have you and just sort of get immersed in the culture.
I'm curious, what was the consensus on whether or not we're entering an era of increased interest or enthusiasm for retro computing?
It was split. Definitely no idea that we're like entering some sort of new golden age or something like that. But about half the people and one of the panelists did feel that we were on an upswing in terms of interest and utility, say over the next couple of years versus the last 4 or 5 years. For the Apple II in general, Apple II usefulness in hardware, and particularly because there have been over the last, say, 2 years, a release of a number of ways to integrate the Apple II into modern networks. There's now the Ethernet card and ways that you can get an Apple II, particularly a 2GS, on the internet, and ways to network it into an existing Mac or PC or Linux network. And because of those, it extends the functionality so much. There's also been a large resurgence in the creation and distribution of disk images, copyright be damned. And so more and more things are available for people that are picking up Apple IIs. And it's very easy to come by software and utilities and things, which otherwise would have been much more difficult.
Gotcha. Well, you mentioned the products hooking up to things and storing information, modern day products for the retro computers. Some of those were introduced at the show, right?
Yeah, there was a few, a bunch of things, but there was a couple of what I would consider big announcements. That was things like Sweet 16 has a nice new version. That's a 2GS emulator, and that came out. But I would say the two big releases so far have been that Richard Dreher announced the CFFA 3000. It's the third version of his CFFA card. And what that is a card that can go into the slot of any Apple II, I believe from a 2 plus up. So a 2 plus, a 2E, an enhanced 2E, or a 2GS. And it takes a compact flash card. That's the CF part of the CFFA. I don't know what the FA part is for. And that acts as a hard drive. So you can take a CF card. You can partition it. You can have up to, 16 different partitions on it, all of which will be seen as little hard drives on your Apple II. So suddenly you've got a massive amount of storage on an Apple II because each one can be 16 megs, 160 megs. I don't know, whatever the number, it can be addressed with the little 8 bits. And so that sort of card has existed before, and that's been a very popular way to get things and operating systems and disk images and stuff onto a 2E or a 2GS because you can use that CF card in a modern computer, write the stuff to it that you want, and just pop it in your 2E, you turn it on, and bingo, you've got access to all those things. This new version adds a couple of really amazing features, one of which is it has a USB port on it as well. So in addition to the CF card, you can now plug in a FAT 8, FAT 12, or FAT 16 format, or FAT 32 formatted USB card. And it can be loaded with disk images. And those disk images act as additional floppy disks on the 2E and has a little button that lets you swap between them. So it's now really convenient to be able to have your CF card loaded. It's your big hard drive. You can even keep it there. And then with a little USB dongle, and you can have a little cable coming out, so you don't have to reach in the machine to do it. You just pop in a USB card, bingo, the computer now sees a disk image or two loaded. You can press a button to swap between them. So if you're working on a game or something, you have a bunch of disk images, you can rotate between them without having to physically swap disks, so it makes it more convenient. So it's a really nice feature, and it gives you two different ways to get big storage into your computer. So that just got released. I picked up one because he had a special here at the show. So $149, I think it's regular $159. But since he was right here, I was able to pick one up and save shipping and stuff. So I have it. This is the bag. That was me wiggling the
nice very, crinkle.
I'm very excited. Well, I like to open things on
good
microphone.
Noise.
Here, I'm opening. I have opened the bag. There.
I hope it's static safe.
But did you say you built one, though?
Well, that's a CFFA card. There also a separate piece of hardware was released. It's Bountiful.
Oh, yeah, I'm on the wrong thing.
Hardware. And this reel, very famous for doing his Apple One replica kit, has come out. He had announced this last year, an A2 MP3 card. It's another card that can pop in any vintage Apple II from an original Apple II up to a 2GS, and it's an MP3 player. It also has a USB port on it. You plug in a thumb drive filled with MP3s, and okay. You can now control that card from your Apple II, even a old vintage Apple IIe, say, and it plays that music. He offers it both as a built item and as a kit, and he ran one of the sessions here was you could sign up and build your own A2 MP3 card and just solder it all together with him there to help you in case you were new to soldering or so. There were 8 of us who signed up, myself included, and we all got together and sat in the big room, and a bunch of people watched us, and we had all the parts, and he went over it with us, and we all soldered together our own A2 MP3 cards, and there was an Apple II there to pop them in and test them, and 8 for 8, all of us were totally successful. Everyone built their card. The instructions and the kit were fantastic. Very, very easy to follow. 2 of the 8 of us had never soldered before. 2 of the people there. This was their first time ever soldering. Mm-hmm. And they were able to easily put together this card and get it into an Apple II and play their own MP3. So it's a great starter kit if you want to get into hardware, but you've never done it. It's a very, very easy kit.
Vince is an old pro. Yeah.
He was great. He was a lot of help too, and it was really, really fun. And you pop the card in, and you hear it playing the MP3s like through your Apple II. Just absolutely fantastic.
Blow your mind.
Yeah, it really was.
I did. I built my replica one, you know, with Vince in the same sort mm-hmm. of thing. A workshop at the Vintage Computer Festival in California, the one and right. only one I've gone to there. So he did that. You know, he did that one there, 2006. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun. A really fantastic session.
I have a question for you back on the CFFA. I was reading on the website about the 3000 version, I guess right. it is, and it seemed like a really impressive piece of hardware, but I was wondering if anybody blinked on the price. I mean, maybe, you know, we joke about the Apple Commodore thing, but, you know, the Commodore world was always about, you know, the more inexpensive. Right. I mean, for the masses, not the classes thing.
cheaper. If you Commodore people are cheap.
So, and there's a product that does something similar to this with an SD card for Commodore stuff that I think is 50, 60 bucks in that price range. And when I had an Apple II before and I looked at the CFFA card, a previous version of it, I loved the idea of what it could do, but I was thinking, wow, $150. Mm-hmm. That's a good chunk of change. So
absolutely. And it is pricier than some of there are competitors even in the Apple II world for this sort of thing that will both run these sorts of solid state cards and also to run other sorts of hard drives, that sort of thing, IDE controllers. And generally they do skew cheaper. One of the advantages of this one is the build quality is excellent, and more particularly with this one, the ability to plug in the thumb drive and have access to disk images that you can then swap, that's a real advantage over the other sorts of cards. And well, it does mean it comes as maybe a $50 price tag increase over some of the other options. I personally felt it was worth it. I didn't even hesitate.
Yeah, and I mean, previous runs, I think, the earlier versions of it, I think, sold out on their production runs and were very popular. So
yep.
I was just curious what your thoughts were on that.
I don't know how large that production run is. Like, it could be that, yeah, they sell out at $150, but the run is quite small. And, you know, he couldn't sell 5,000 of them at this price or something. I don't know. But I do know that, yeah, I believe that the previous runs have always sold out.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, granted, the Apple II market was huge, too, but the Commodore 64 market was gigantic. So I don't know. Yes. Maybe the Commodore guy can sell a lot more of them.
It also may be that Apple II people have a much higher standard for quality than you Commodore people. I think that probably is a major part of the difference. That we just won't put up with the sort of nonsense that you guys are willing to.
More money to burn.
It could be that as well. It's just how we roll.
Awesome. Well, anything else you want to tell us about Kansas Fest before we slip on?
No, but I can tell you that my roomie, Dr. Steve, as I now call him, has actually just returned. Say hello.
Hello.
That was him saying hello.
Hey there, Steve. Tell him hi from us.
No, I'm not going to pass that.
Yeah.
I've got the headphones. Only I get to hear what you say.
He's got the power.
I got the power.
You said you're hosting next time, right? Oh my!
I just want to know where's he been.
Next time I get to host. And so, anyway, to wrap up the Kansas Fest stuff, though, it's a fantastic event, really. If you're interested in the Apple II community, this is the one chance, honestly, the one chance a year that you can gather and experience this sort of thing. The Apple II community is amazingly giving and wonderful, and they reach out all year long, and there's lots of virtual ways to be involved. You can get on different websites. You can interact with people in so many remote ways, which is amazing now. Like, that's just – it's totally different than it was 10 years ago, and that's awesome, awesome, awesome. But it's still nothing like coming here and being up till 2 in the morning hanging out in the hallway with people and having breakfast with them and getting in sessions with people and just really immersing yourself in and with other people who like this sort of thing. For instance, this evening, Andrew Malloy, he has a game called Star Saga 1 that he just got here at Kansas Fest, picked up from a fellow attendee. And it's a six-person star-based or space-based role-playing game with the computer access, the game master, and each of the one through six people, humans, get to play one of the roles. And it's a big role-playing game. And we're going to play it this evening. So it'll be Andrew, I'm going to play as well, and we'll get at least four others. And Andrew was saying that this – he wants to play it, and he wants to play it with six people because once he goes home, as much as we have a wonderful community in the Apple II, there is no chance in heck he is going to find five people willing to sit down and play an Apple II place-based role-playing game with him. It's just not going to happen. So This is the place where you can get that sort of experience that you're not going to find elsewhere. And whether it's just for the Apple II or vintage computers in general, this event is just fantastic. Like, I just can't speak highly enough. It's amazingly well organized, tons of information, and most importantly, tons of fun and tons of community. On Google Plus recently, the gal from the guild, whatever her name is, Felicia Day, she was posting some tips about how to get through Comic-Con, about how to get through the heat, that kind of stuff. And the fourth tip, and which I thought was the most important, was just enjoy yourself, that being a geek is about community. And that's exactly what this is. This is exactly that. You're surrounded by people who share that same exact love for vintage computers, and there's no experience like it.
Awesome. I'm so glad you had such a good time. That's so
amazing.
Cool.
I have one last question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Is the keynote already done or no?
Yeah, the keynote happens early on. It sort of kicks it off in typical keynote style.
Who was it this year?
The keynote was...
Am I putting you on the spot?
Putting you on the spot. I can't remember. Hold on. I was even there.
Well, I have the email.
It was Bob Bishop. Of course, it was Bob Bishop.
All right, Bob Bishop. I'm sorry.
I was looking up, actually. My roomie helped me out with that one by shedding it over. We're using... I don't know if you guys have used it, but there's a great piece of iOS software called Guidebook that we're using here, and it gives you a digital schedule. It's free software. And you can, if you're running an event, you can sign up for a free account or a very expensive paid account. They're using the free account here. And you can upload schedules and maps and that sort of thing. And all your attendees can simply use Guidebook and they say, yeah, I'm attending, in this case, Kansas Fest. And it has the schedule and to-do lists and all those things. And whenever they update it, because things move around and they're very fluid here, you immediately get an update so I can look at the schedule and it's always up to the minute in local time and with maps and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. It's fantastically useful. It's the first time at Kansas Fest I think they've been using it.
Very nice. Did you call that Guidebook?
Yeah, it's called Guidebook. Yeah, and it's really
awesome.
Handy. And another digital tool they've been using is called Backchan. Do you guys know that? It's a website-based thing called – it's at backchan.nl. And you can use that to have audience members interact with a panel. So we'll be at the panel. They'll say, hey, remember to use Backchan. You can log into Backchan. It has the entire schedule for I'm attending for this event. So it'll say, here's what's happening at Kansas Fest. I can click on the actual panel or session that I'm in, and you can type in questions. And other members of the audience can vote them up and vote them down. And the moderator can look down and see the audience's reactions and questions in real time and say, okay, we have a question from the audience and the most popular one currently is this. And he can ask them out. So it makes it even all the more interactive. And you can throw out questions right in the middle of somebody speaking and not worry about interrupting them. And other people can see the questions. So for a geek event like this, it's been amazingly useful.
Yeah, that sounds. Yeah. It sounds like they could even use something like that, say on Twit Live or something like that.
Sure. It's been great. And again, I think you'll see nothing like that kind of technology ever used at a Commodore event.
Oh, God.
They couldn't handle it
because
it's too much tech for you guys.
Stop it.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Because there's a couple of them coming up.
Was that still Guidebook? Because I was looking up Guidebook for iOS.
Yeah, Guidebook.nl.
Okay.
Weirdly, yes. Guidebook.nl.
No, I think at the Commodore events, they're still using that two tin cans and a string.
I would assume so. Yes. So anyway, legal Kansas pad. Test, totally awesome. Yeah, but it's been a fantastic time.
What? Does someone say go away in the background?
No, that's in the background. There's people in the hallway. So they're talking about the big green bus. There's a massive green bus here, and it's loaded with hardware. And there's a pool table at the moment with hundreds of magazines on it that are all about to be given away, all vintage. Insider and A2+ magazines, that kind of stuff. And just piled up and piled up. So.
Are you going to jump into the scrum there to
jump into the scrum? No.
Pick up some of them? Or?
Yeah. Yes, I am. Yeah, can't wait. People are just going to help unload it right now.
I see.
Small work sort of thing. But I'm going to podcast and let them do that work. And then I'll just go cruise by and pick up some free hardware.
Yeah, and then go get the fruits of their labor. Hey, I think the next thing on our list was the Video Game History Museum, and that was you too, right, Carrington?
I just can't speak enough clearly. Yes. It's a Kickstarter project. I don't know a lot about it other than there is the Video Game History Museum is itself a charitable organization. They seem to have quite the collection of video games, more console-oriented video games, but all vintage stuff. And it has exhibited at a few events previously, like E3 and stuff. And what they have is a Kickstarter campaign on right now to try to raise the funds so that they can get a better place to permanently house it, and more importantly, get a better, more portable way that they can display it so it can tour more and visit more events. So I believe it's just launched. I don't know a lot about it, but it does seem like a pretty cool thing. So if you're into vintage video games and would like to have more of those things touring and showing at modern video game events, it might be something people would be interested in supporting.
Yeah, the one link, there's tons of information. And then, of course, there's a link to the Kickstarter campaign itself. And there's just, tons of information here. So there's 40 days to go. They're almost a third to their goal of $30,000.
And it looks like the Video Game History Museum, it says it's a 501c3 nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be awesome to have something like that touring. We've got actually an exhibit going on right now here at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry called Game On. That is, I haven't been. I would like to go if I get the chance. But from what I understand, it's kind of a video games for all the way from Pong to modern kind of stuff, and even virtual reality immersion and stuff like that. I got to read more about it. It sounded great, but I mean something like this that could go all over the place and show off to people. We need something like this for vintage computing, don't you think? Like a moving tour of vintage computing that could go to different museums and different exhibit halls in various places. That would be awesome.
And maybe be able to show it places that don't have necessarily big museums, mm-hmm. so it could expose more people to it. It's a really good idea. Yeah.
So this project here may be a good model.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that this group.
The actual group behind this, they are the ones who published something called the Digital Press Collector's Guide, which they are saying contains a complete listing and descriptions of every game ever made for every console. That's quite the claim. Now, I wonder if that's actually true. I'm dying to look at it, but I was like,
if we find one exception to that rule, we can call them out.
And no equivocating. That's what it says. Like, literally, so which contains complete listings and descriptions of every game ever made for every console. And that's a very clear statement. So nice. It says it's the Blue Book of Video Game Collecting. Frankly, I never even heard of it, but I'm not a video game collector, so.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Wasn't there a thing about – whoops. It is close. About the actual – the gaming expo or whatever.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So they're talking about that they have –
that's July 31st, August 1st.
Right, that, yes. This event, they're saying that they've got dozens. What I'm most interested in, the reason why this Kickstarter one caught my eye is it's just not that they've got a bunch of items and it's, hey, we want to tour the world with our Commodore 64s, but it's that they're saying that they have a few dozen or dozens of one-of-a-kind items, and it's about really exposing the very unique items of gaming hardware and software and documentation that you're simply not going to see elsewhere, and they want to make sure they preserve it and tour with it because it's all very unique items. So that's what really caught my eye with this one.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things that you ordinarily wouldn't get a chance to see that I think would be a cool part of an exhibit like this. Like, I wonder if they have a Fairchild, you know, one of the first cartridge-based kind of systems like that. I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to see one of those for real, but it would be cool to see it something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, but speaking of Kickstarter, David, you hit your goal on your Kickstarter.
Yay! Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yep. I did. I was still trying to find how I clicked off on that gaming expo. I like messed up all
on,
my
David.
Here.
We're not focusing on you.
Yes, I did, and thank you very much. And I just went over $2,000. And guess by who?
I don't know.
None other than Carrington Vanston.
Oh, I'm taking it back then.
Today,
I didn't mean to support that. That was a mistake. I meant to support something else.
I haven't actually sent you your official email through the system saying thank you, but so thanks, Carrington.
Well, no problem.
You're going to get a special edition?
No. it's not just me. A ton of people clearly support it, and you hit your goal very quickly and deservedly. I mean, it's an amazing project. We were talking about it here at Kansas Fest, and people were like, people knew about it. I mean, I'm not surprised that you hit your goal. Everyone's quite excited about it.
Yeah, I'm real excited. You know, it's something I've been wanting to do for a long time, so finally doing it. So now I'm looking at the page. So yeah, so I tried to come up with what I thought was a reasonable goal that would get enough books printed to, which I'll explain, for the people that essentially are pre-buying them as well as have others to sell. So, you know, I used to publish a newsletter called the Historically Brewed, and it was like the official publication of the Historical Computer Society, which I hope to have made into a worldwide user group. It sort of was for a while. So basically, I'm taking all 9 of those issues and making them into a compilation book. And then the first dozen or so pages will have my story of how I first got into collecting computers and, you know, and starting the club and publishing, and then kind of the decline, and then what I'm doing now, and some pictures and other things. So, so a goal of $1,200. Let's see, I've got 53 backers 24 days ago, and it's $2,005. So as of now, I think I was calculating it. I can publish about 200 books. So I intend to try to get them on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everything.
Very nice. This Kickstarter thing is really an interesting concept, just in general.
It is.
And this was your first foray with them, right?
It was. And the way I found out about it was because of Jason Scott. So getting familiar with him, and then, of course, his DVDs and his documentaries and, you know, his stuff, the things that he does. And then he was on the show one time, and so I don't remember how it was brought to my attention, but he did a Kickstarter project back in late 2009. And what was it called? The Jason Scott going blank here. But basically, he raised enough money to quit his job, the Jason Scott sabbatical, that's what it was called. So he was able to raise enough money to quit his job and full-time finish GitLamp and his other projects.
I didn't know that's how he did that.
Yeah,
$26,000.
So, so this Kickstarter thing is a great way for people to fund creative projects. It's not meant to be a fundraising or like a charity sort of thing, but, like what I'm doing is a great example. We're basically... people are pledging money, and then there's rewards. But essentially, you're pre-buying the book. In my case,
amazing.
Now, yeah, it's more like the concept. It's more like the name. What they're saying, it kickstarts
what
you're trying to accomplish.
And I think it enables things that, I mean, how would otherwise, if you didn't have Kickstarter, frankly, how would you have gone about this? Like, where do you go knocking on doors to raise $2,000?
Yeah,
like, it enables these things where people want to fund something that honestly I don't see how otherwise it would get funded. And that's what I like about it, is it's enabling things that I think otherwise would never get to happen.
Well,
to bring things back to Kansas Fest, just quickly to interject about Jason Scott, with whom I had dinner this evening because he's here.
Oh, that's right.
He's the
there.
One who moderated that panel on the Golden Age stuff. He also gave another talk and has been talking about archive.org and the things that they've been doing now. Fascinating and interesting fellow, and
where he works there, right? He works at
archive.org. Just amazing, yeah. So exactly. So he was talking about the trials that they've had with Archive. He has something going on later this evening called Jason Scott's Modest Proposal. And he's going to be proposing to us something about how we can contribute and work on behalf of Archive.org. I don't know what it is yet because it's going to be happening later this evening. But again, that's the sort of thing that happens at this event. It's very exciting. Just to bring it back, I'm sort of living the Kansas Fest stuff full time right now.
Yeah, it's well, and you know this Kickstarter thing. There's actually a documentary that is going to be made about the Amiga. And,
oh right.
You know, Viva Amiga, and from what I understand, they've
got
also
canceled.
Met.
No, it got canceled.
No, they
I
went
just
over.
Heard that got canceled.
I don't think the documentary got canceled, right?
Don't be a hater.
No, honestly, as much as, you know, I wish it nothing but ill because it's not Apple. No, I'm kidding. I thought the actual documentary got canceled. Was it just the talk
got
canceled?
I think it's just the talk that got canceled. I was looking at that and, you know, the wording, you were probably looking at the Convex.
The Convex, which I guess segues
site,
us into that.
Which I think, I'm going on record here to say I believe that is just, what would I say, misleading wording, not misleading on purpose, but just kind of poorly worded.
I think,
you know,
right, it says Viva Amiga canceled, but when I read the description, it just says Zach Weddington, producer of the Viva Amiga film, has dropped out. I think it's just that.
I think it was just dropped out of the event.
Oh,
the Kickstarter thing is funded at $29,656, and their goal was
$25,000. He doesn't want to come and talk.
No, when I read that verbiage that you're talking about, Carrington, I went to the Kickstarter site. I went out to, you know, everywhere that I could find news on this kind of thing, and it looked like all systems are still go. So I think it's just
when I read that, I just leapt to that conclusion and then did nothing else about it but spread the rumor.
Well,
so this is the difference between you and I, Earl. It's just the different way we react.
What was the event?
Yeah, well, I guess we should talk about that. Sorry, who threw that on our lineup?
Well, I guess we can.
What was the event that they supposedly dropped out of or whatever? I just wanted to do a search.
It's called Convex, and it's in its seventh year now. It's a Commodore Expo that's in Las Vegas, which, you know, actually has one or two hotels there where you can hold something like this. And from what I've heard, you know, the show just gets better and better every year. I talk to people who go, I haven't been myself yet. Gosh, I wish I could go. This year they're going to talk about all kinds of things. I mean, everything from sounded like the PET to the Amiga. They talk about flash cartridges, programming, some products that are either available now or forthcoming, connecting to the internet. And, you know, just lots of stuff. So, again, you're right, Carrington. Nothing even approximates the camaraderie of a dorm experience like Kansas Fest. But I have heard, though, this event is just a ton of fun. So,
and well, maybe it's not as like long-term of immersive as Kansas Fest. I do think attending an event like this, like even Convex or whatever, is the thing that, you know, you want to go to the event where they're discussing the sort of tech that appeals to you, whether that's Commodore or Apple or video games or what have you. But I would encourage people to, if they're interested in this stuff, to get out and make the attempt, drop in on events like that. Because
Yeah, absolutely. Get out, socialize, you know, that kind of thing. Like I'll talk about at the end of the program tomorrow. I'm actually making the jaunt again up to Seattle, which is one of the reasons we're recording Friday night. Instead of Saturday morning, like we normally do. But the other reason, of course, was cool to get Carrington while he's actually on the scene, on the move.
I'm hepped up and high on Apple II stuff.
At an event. But so another thing that's coming up here, and this one's in the Portland area, it's called the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. And they've done this several years in a row as well. I don't know exactly how many years this has gone, but again, I've talked to people who have gone, and, you know, this is mostly focused around vintage gaming, you know, vintage consoles and that kind of thing. But there's a lot, from what I understand, of vintage computing gaming represented at this event also. And I'm really excited because I'm actually going in, you know, with the press pass and, you know, doing the, if things come together as they're scheduled, I have a video crew with me and we're going to go in and do interviews and, you know, go kind of catch what's going on there on the activities. So
this looks like a fantastic event. I am jealous. I'm going to try to see if I can make it down to this one. This looks great.
Oh, they have tons of fun there. There's, you know, free play consoles where you can go, you know, get your asteroids on, you know, and there's computer systems on exhibit, tournaments, various contests that they have, and there's some presentations too. So yeah, it's kind of a mix. I don't think they have the press release for this year's event out. I was checking the site, and so, you know, some of the information I'm extrapolating from what they've done in the past. So it's probably not going to be identical. You know, there might be a little change here and there, but always a fun time. And I'll have more information for you guys as this event sneaks up, you know, as it's getting closer. And especially when they get the press release out and, you know, get some more of the details up online, I'll be sure to talk about it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just looking at the website for Convex. I totally missed this. I hadn't heard about it or anything.
You're still on Convex. We've moved on.
Yeah, I'm Convex, so... their motto is Vegas, baby.
And that's an advantage. I mean, as much as this being at Kansas Fest has been amazing because you just live and breathe the Apple II and only the Apple II for 5 days straight. If you wanted to have something where it didn't have to be so immersive and so, you know, all vintage all the time, going to an event like Convex, which is in – it only takes the weekend and is in a place like Las Vegas, like you could incorporate that into a larger sort of just trip or vacation. So,
yeah, you could tack a day on the beginning or the end. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do that actually.
Yeah.
Like, just kind of, you know, chill out a little bit in Vegas, have some fun, and then – go do the Commodore thing.
Right. But this gaming expo looks really, really fun.
Yeah, now I'm there. I've caught up. Sorry.
Stay with us, David.
That's why I chose to do the show on Saturday morning.
You're like a 300 baud there, David.
that's going to be my new phrase. You're so 300 baud. Come on, David. Go full duplex on us.
David, did you put this next one on, the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest?
Oh, yeah.
It's just festival.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to enter the golden days of these sort of things, right? So I think our hobby has finally reached a respectable age or level or something. But
no,
yes.
I do not want to be respectable. I'll be anything else, but I'll stop short there.
So this is a they did this last year. It's a dual event or a shared event, and so they're doing it again this year. So it's the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest 6.0, along with the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention 2011 in Lombard, Illinois, which I believe it's outside Chicago somewhere, if I'm not mistaken. So there's two different links here. Okay, Chicagoland Commodore Expo. Two great shows, one great non-price. It's free.
Mm-hmm. There's not much on the VCFMW site yet.
Yeah.
I like the look of it, though. It's all very vintage looking.
With the bar paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's definitely a scan of a real sheet of paper there.
Yeah, nice.
I know the name of that show has always cracked me up. How do you have an emergency Commodore convention? Red alert.
Hilarious.
I think
I
still have
the Commodores. Give me 10 milligrams of stat. I don't know how that happened.
Oh, wait, here it is, because I have a link to there. Well, okay, it's in the show notes, too, but they've kept this little saying. It says, true comrades will heed the call of the party and gather once more at the appointed place at the appointed hour. Let none of us say he was not willing to stand up for the cause of liberation.
Oh, you Commodore people. Oh,
I'm so serious. Anyway, it's a fun name, right?
So people will have to make a choice, though, because this is happening the same weekend as that Portland Retro Gaming Expo.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Which will you go to?
And, you know, ironically, we're also scheduled to record that day. But, you know, if I can do it, maybe it'd be fun.
We expect you to record from both of them.
Simultaneously. I could phase like Wesley Crusher. I could be, you know, both. That'd be cool, actually. All right, that was
Star Trek Next Generation reference.
And with that, I'm moving on. Let's talk about eBay auctions. Carrington, what happened to your auction that you had from last time?
It's sold for $1 million. I don't know. Let me go take a look. Sorry, I haven't actually looked at it.
See. Oh, it did sell.
Actually, it did sell for almost $1 million. Nice. Well, 600.
I can't look at it because the network is telling me no, I can't. I shouldn't have made that attempt, actually.
Oh, I got
no,
21 bids.
$600.
Yeah, it sold for
21
nice.
Bids. Wow.
Yeah. Holy cow.
Those things
can
are
I
pretty rare.
Can I pick them?
Yeah. But you're right on this one. It's a rare there's a small audience perhaps, but you know, it's rare enough.
That's amazing that it went for $600.
Who wouldn't want an 18 megahertz 2GS?
Well, that's it. Like, I mean, being overclocked like that, it's a unique version of this. But still, holy cow! And what I'm really happy about that this, you know, maybe it was part of the community as well. This was being sold by John Littlejohn, who's here at the event. When I was saying earlier, the big green bus full of stuff, it's his bus.
Huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, it's full of Sean Fahey's stuff. He went to Sean Fahey's garage, and basically anybody in a community, whoever gets rid of anything, Sean takes it in and has the most enormous collection imaginable. And it's sort of a tradition that he brings heaps and heaps and heaps to distribute here at Kansas Fest. So it's John Littlejohn's bus full of Sean Fahey's stuff. But anyway, yeah, so sold for $600. That's amazing. I'll have to go congratulate John when I see him.
Now, my terminal didn't do nearly as well. It looks like it didn't sell at all for $55 and got relisted. But,
yeah,
oh,
and
then well.
Didn't sell.
Yeah, maybe I've got a chance at one of these someday, huh?
I'm actually a little surprised. I'm a little surprised at that. I thought that would sell.
Yeah, me too. You know, I saw some terminals that weren't nearly this good a shape when I went last time we were in Seattle. I went to this place called RePC that is a... they call it recycled, you know, electronics and computing. It's not really recycled. It's just, you know, more or less like an old computer kind of place where you go in. You know, it's this warehouse kind of experience. You go in, you're kind of flipping through power adapters or old computers or components and that kind of thing. They had terminals there, and the terminals I think had $50 or $60 listed on them, and they were not in as good a shape as this. So,
I don't know if it makes a difference, but the shipping price, at least for me, showing international mail, has dropped by like $5. So
yeah, my shipping price shows cheaper than that original listing as well. So we'll see what happens. What
but
about
it's such nice shape? I'm very surprised at that. Anyway, yeah,
it's a beautiful terminal. What happened with your
Lisa? I see a trend here. It did not sell. Was relisted.
No, a trend. Mine sold. There's no trend here.
Well, a trend with the Wise terminals because it was relisted and then ended on the 16th and did not sell, even at a starting bid of $999, which is maybe a little high. But then including an ImageWriter printer. See, I don't know. Maybe the ImageWriter printer kind of hurts it because of the shipping costs.
I think it does because that just increases shipping. And frankly, you can pick those up. They're not really worth that much. You can pick those up cheap. So the $1,000 starting bid is probably what hurt that one.
You know, a quick discussion item too. Do you guys, well, I guess, Karen, because I know you've always said you're not really a big collector anyway, but
no.
So maybe I'll throw this to you, Earl, a little bit more. But like if someone says, hey, Earl, I got this computer and you can have it. Do you want to come get it? And you're interested and they say, oh, and I got this printer for it too. Generally, would you be like, oh, I'd love to have the computer, but I don't really want the printer? Or would you want the printer?
Well, would I want the printer or would I take the printer? Because that's two separate questions. So let me tell you what happened to me one time. Somebody had a parallel port zip drive that they wanted me to come get, and I wanted that to hook to my old IBM PC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can use that on the older stuff.
Because you can do it. So I went there, and kind of the condition of picking it, this was on FreeCycle, and the condition of picking it up was that I haul away a bunch of other computer stuff that they had too, and one of it was like a Pentium 2 Compaq and, you know, some other stuff that ordinarily I'd have just looked at that and went, you know, yeah, not really much interest, but... I don't want to discourage people from giving me cool stuff. So, typically, you know, I will take it all. And if there's stuff that is absolute junk, like no utility whatsoever, then I'll go ahead and take care of recycling that.
I do that too on a local level.
Or maybe giving it to somebody who might have an interest in it. You know, maybe there's somebody else who wants this thing and I don't want it, but it's cool. And so, yeah, I'll take it all.
Or you can take it to a thrift store. You know, and then
that's true too.
Basically, they don't want it anymore, though.
It's like a lot of them, stuff. Yeah.
So, but getting into the current auctions that we have up here, Carrington, David, and I were wondering what CPU this Polaroid camera is using. I mean, is that an old 6502?
I just went a different way. It's technology.
You're breaking the rules.
I'm not breaking my auctions sell. Don't tell me about breaking the rules. You can pick up and sell one day, and you can then chastise me. So I decided to go with the Polaroid SX70 vintage pop-up folding land camera, and you both shut your mouths. It's cool.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture.
I got a couple questions for you when you're done.
It's going to appeal to the hipsters. The hipsters are going to love this thing, but aside from just the hipsters, I find the appeal of these land cameras is very similar to me anyway, to the appeal of using a vintage computer. It's the same thing. It's it's bigger, it's heavier, it's slower, what have you, but it's also more beautiful. It's more tactile. And this is an example of, well, it's not computer technology, it's photography technology. It was the first instant SLR camera that they designed. It's absolutely gorgeous. I find that the pop-up look of this thing is totally stunning. This is a good price for this as well. Typically, a good one of these is going to sell for $150 to $300. Mm-hmm. So this is a buy it now at $100. So frequently, these will come up. And I thought it was something interesting to talk about because with these are fairly rock solid items. Because of the Impossible Project, you can actually get film for them now. So something like
I was going to ask about that because you know with the current with vintage computers, you know we have trouble getting media or
exactly. And so this does away with the media problem because you can actually get current film. It's also fun to use vintage expired films because you get weird sort of effects and you can pick up expired film for this quite cheaply and then not feel like you're spending a fortune when you're taking a risk on what it's going to look like when it develops. The land camera had a few different versions and eventually evolved into the Polaroid One Shot or whatever. This is the first model. And if you're going to pop for one of these things, the ones to consider, I think, are simply the first edition or the second edition. The advantage of the first edition was that it's basically chrome plated. Makes it quite heavy, but it's very, very durable. It's real leather. The thing is rock solid. The second
version, luxury cameras. I mean, this was an expensive camera. Yeah.
It was. And what's fun about getting into something like a land camera, it has a huge number of accessories available for it. Flashes and automatic focusing devices and lots of folding cases and macro things and colored lenses and lots of stuff that you can sort of build out a whole kit. So it's fun to, if you're interested in photography, it's a fun camera to add to a collection because you can build out things. The second edition of it is usually available much cheaper because it's not the highly collectible first one. It's also a lot lighter because it's then all plastic. It looks the same, but it's not going to feel the same. But it did add a much more pleasant focusing. It went for rangefinder focusing on the second one, so it's easier to use that way. The first edition is a little more finicky when it comes to focusing, but I think it makes it a little more fun to work with as well. I don't actually own one of these things, but for some reason I seem to know about them, so part of me must really want one. I think it's a fun piece of vintage technology in a sense, but it's photography technology. I love the way it folds out and yet gives you a full SLR path inside it. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking through is the actual lens. It's all a single lens reflex. And it's a totally gorgeous camera from the 70s. And, you know, I think the hipsters are going to love it.
Yeah, it was like amazing. I remember when it came out seeing commercials. But here, so I got a couple of trivia questions for you then. I think you might have answered it already. So other than how cool it looks and the fact that it folds down and pops up, you know, that was unique. But so what was significant about this Polaroid camera then?
Well, I think because it was the first instant SLR. There were instant cameras before this, but as far as I know, this was the first instant SLR camera.
What do you mean by – what does SLR
single,
mean?
Single lens reflex means instead of – most cameras, you look through one hole, but the camera lens, a different hole is what is exposing the film. With an SLR, what you look through is in the actual path. So when you're looking, a mirror is showing you exactly what is coming in through the lens. So when you press the shutter, a mirror flips over and it bounces that ray to hit the film instead of your eye. That's why an SLR, it'll go black for a second when you click the shutter.
And that I'm not sure. You might be right. I noticed that the viewfinder, if you look, you know, you're looking through at the top and you're not – it's looking – it's actually coming out, you know, right next to where the lens is.
Right, yeah. It bounces through like a series of mirrors, and there's one mirror inside it that rotates. That's how SLRs work even today.
But I
may also be talking complete smack. I don't really know a lot about
that. And I'm no expert either, but I think this is what's significant about it, is that Polaroids before this time, because I remember this, because my grandparents had one, you took the picture, right?
Right.
And then you grabbed a little paper thing, and you pulled the picture out. And then you would look at your watch, and you'd flip it around, and you'd wait 1 or 2 minutes or whatever. Then you'd carefully peel a piece of paper off the top, and there was your exposed picture.
Yes, versus this is the first way at all. Nope.
This is the first one where you just sat there and watched it develop.
Yeah, and it just comes out and develops. The neat thing about Polaroid film, including this one, the way what made Polaroid famous is the battery for operating the camera is in the film pack, but the film is itself completely self-contained. So that's why you can buy a camera from the 1970s and not worry that, well, how do I get a battery for it or whatever. It's built into the film. The film itself is like a self-contained unit. This sort of film, the film you're going to get for it nowadays, isn't the sort that you have to shake and you can write on and make changes.
Yeah.
Although I believe – I might be wrong because I can't really get on there and look for it. I think the Impossible Project has come out with a modifiable film that you can sketch on.
I'll put a link in the show notes to Retro Thing because they did an article about that project. Whatever. But here's my second trivia question.
An odd choice, but I'm choosing a 1970s camera. So
What is the significance of the word Land?
Oh, that's the fellow. George Land, Jim Land, something Land. His last name. He was like a Polaroid film camera designer guy. That's why it's called a Land camera. He was the actual designer of this sort of thing and this sort of film.
You got
He's like the inventor of this sort of film.
You beat me.
Awesome. Yeah, he got your trivia questions there, David.
Yep. So there.
David, tell us about the video brain.
Well, this is a machine I'm not that familiar with. Let me go there.
I'm going to give you trivia.
Yeah, I've heard about it forever, the video brain. So I'm very familiar with the name over the years of collecting and reading and stuff, but it's from 1977. It's called the Video Brain Vintage Cartridge Computer. See, it's got 4 days left. It's at $50. Very low shipping.
Look at this thing.
But it's very cool, and someone could pick it up cheaply, you know.
I've heard of this guy, and I'm betting that in the end, this guy goes for way more than
maybe
it
so.
Is.
But I also put a link in the show.
Left, and it's just got the one bid.
I put a link in the show notes to the Wikipedia article, which obviously you could learn a whole lot more about the company. And it's an 8-bit home computer, it says, based on the Fairchild Semiconductor F8 CPU. So that would put it in the same as that Fairchild gaming system, I think, maybe. Right, Earl?
Nice. So depending on when this show gets broadcast, there might be only a little bit of time left in this. And I would think people should run over and look at this. This is a really cool item.
Yeah, and it's black. That's kind of neat. Odd-looking keyboard layout there. And
then, totally.
And what's the plug? Is that the power in the front of it like that?
I don't know.
But I guess you're not really using the keyboard as much as... Well, yeah, it's a computer versus... Obviously, it was more of a game system, I'm thinking.
And again, this is 1977. I mean, imagine, you know, the Commodore PET in 77 came out with that weird chiclet keyboard. You know, when it was first introduced, the idea that a computer would have a nice Selectric, you know, kind of quality keyboard sort of environment was not necessarily established at that point. So.
A nerve.
According to Wikipedia, there were two hardware expansion things that came out. One was a cassette recorder and one was an interface, give different iOS devices. But because it got canceled so quickly and I guess failed commercially so miserably, fewer than 25 titles were ever marketed. So there's not a lot of games for it.
Wow.
Guys, are you still on the eBay page for Video Brain?
Yep,
I am. I just got to point this out. Scroll down and you see where it says, see more items just like this. And then it says Vintage Computer Rage, 1977 board game. Do you see that?
No.
I don't see that.
No?
On the page that I'm on, no.
Huh. I want to have computer rage. Show me.
But
you're on a different eBay than I am.
Oh. Well, anyway, it's kind of, I noticed that and I clicked on it and the board, like the box cover is just kind of funny from 1977. Anyway, so look it up, Vintage Computer Rage. I guess I'll put a link in the show notes.
Well, I'm going to talk about, I stole your tweet, David.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, you tweeted about the CompuColor 2,
right?
And I just blatantly plagiarized you and made that my eBay auction that I want to talk about.
My cool eBay Friday?
I love this computer. In fact, I believe I either did a full podcast episode or at least part of one of the retro bits. One of the earlier episodes was on this particular
one. It was part, if I recall. It wasn't the full, but you did talk about this, definitely.
Because this beast was – the first time that I saw this was in the high school computer science room. And a buddy of mine whose dad worked for IBM and who actually taught me a lot about programming anyway, he had one of these on loan to him. And so he brought it in for us all to see. And there were some things about this computer that just captivated me. I mean, you know, one of those love at first sight things that, you know, decades later, I can still remember that. One of the things was the keyboard. I mean, now this was the deluxe model of the keyboard. You see this thing has like a million keys on it, but there were actually several different choices of keyboard that you could connect to the CompuColor. But one of the cool things about it was it wasn't just the video of the computer that was in color. The keyboard was very colorful, had different, mm-hmm. you know, color keys for different purposes and stuff like that. I wonder why they don't even make keyboards like this today, you know, make something where you mix it up and have, you know, kind of a rainbow going on the keyboard. But
it's a big keyboard. It makes me think of some early pictures I've seen of like Asian keyboards where they just seem to have two and three times as many keys on them.
It's a huge
keyboard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I worked for Epson, you know, I saw one of the Japanese keyboards.
Yeah, crazy.
Epson computer. Another interesting thing about this guy is that they stuck, as I recall, the computer brains inside the
display, right?
Inside the display area. Yeah. So, and, you know, finally, you know, one interesting thing is they didn't actually ship a disk formatting program for this, so they tried to get you to buy all of your diskettes from them, from CompuColor.
Oh, gosh.
And, of course, you know, one of the first thing enthusiasts did was write a disk formatting program so that you...
This seems to come with that, too. It seems to come with something called Formatter.
So, yeah, this, it's just such a... And, it, you know, yeah, they don't show it powered on here, but... One of the amazing things about this computer was the crisp color of the text. I mean, this and an NEC that came out, an NEC 8-bit that came out a couple of years later, and I can't remember the name of it, but I remember both of those computers because of just the vibrant color that you'd see on the screen, you know, that beat everything else out there that I'd seen. And, you know, they had some programs running on it that showed some of the color graphics and stuff like that. It was beautiful. So anyway, and they're very rare, so I'm not surprised that with 3.5 days left, this is going for $510, and it'll probably, like, eke up from there.
Yeah, I was surprised at that.
Looking at the description, the reason they're not showing it powered on is it doesn't work at the moment. He says he powered it on a few weeks ago, and he smelled smoke and shut it off. Checking the CPU board inside reveals that a capacitor is smoking. And I think he's right in that. But on old computers, that happens a lot. And they're popping off a capacitor and soldering on another one. It's not a big deal.
It happened to me recently on the TRS-80 Model 3.
Yeah, it happened to you. I remember when you were trying to make that film.
Yeah, right. I was reading on the Wikipedia for it, and it says that to lower cost, the original CompuColor's custom monitor and housing was repackaged into a standard GE 13-inch color television set.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. Man, I'd love to have one of these. I'd love to have one of these that's working, but I knew this would be a little rich for my blood. But
yeah.
Wow.
A great pick. Nice.
Kids don't need to eat next
week. That's true. I'm going to talk to them about that. What is this eating stuff you guys
do? Just put off the next car payment.
So, all right. Well, we're a little over time, but I don't think people will mind. But, you know, maybe we'll swing into the wrap-up section here. Carrington, you know, bring us home. What have you got to parting shots here?
Nothing much. A couple more days of Kansas Fest, which I'm looking forward to. I won't be staying right through to Sunday because I've got to make the long drive back up to Toronto and get back to work. So I'll be leaving tomorrow. But just looking forward to another night and day of the fun here. And then back to the regular routine.
How long of a drive was it, or is it?
It's about 1,700 or 1,800 kilometers, so it's maybe 20 hours total drive.
Ooh. Yeah, that's
it. You know, I'm spreading it over 3 days, so it's not a big deal.
Yeah. What's a kilometer? It's a
kilometer is 10,000 miles. That's Canadians. We just
you guys go
take
really
it in stride. We're a forging people, you know, we're the old French Canadian thing.
Group.
Exactly.
I think really roughly, isn't it, it's like maybe a 0.6 mile.
And the thing is, I'm not actually driving. I'm actually doing this as a portage. So it's just me in a canoe, fording rivers. It's just what I do. I'm Canadian.
Yeah, kilometers, 0.62 miles, approximately.
But it varies. Kilometers aren't a fixed thing. It comes down to mood. Again, it's just...
Did you say 1,700?
1,700. That's what I said, but you can't necessarily believe what I said.
1,056 miles.
That's a nonsense number. You're miles.
That's a long way.
Yeah, it was not a long way to come for an event this awesome.
That's cool.
Ask Earl if there was somehow an event this good for Commodore, he'd go to it.
Oh, absolutely.
He is. He does. Yeah,
and you know, for all the joking I do with Commodore, or actually, is that you, Carrington? I think that's you that does all the
Commodore. Might be me. Yeah.
But I have to admit, you know, I'm kind of platform agnostic here. You know, played with them all, loved
me
them
too.
All.
Me too. You know, totally. But, me too.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah, definitely.
And what about you, David? What have you been up to? Or what are you going to be up to?
Well, I'm happy to report that, so the little organization we got going here, the Atlanta Historical Computing Society, we now have a proper place to meet. So one of our members has gotten permission from his church to, in their, you know, like a meeting hall. So that's great news where we can actually have tables and, because so far we've met at my garage a couple of times and just in a couple of restaurants, and you can't really obviously haul computers in and work on them in restaurants. And, so that's exciting. So that's next weekend, next Saturday. And I've gotten kind of interested in PCs lately, partly because of Earl, because you were talking about in your, I guess,
what
Earl,
I do?
You were...
Oh, rebuilding that clone?
What did I do?
Yeah, yeah. You were tweeting it or somewhere. Yeah. I followed you about it.
Yeah, no, I was rebuilding a, you know, my PC portable went on the blink, and I was like, that's it, you're done. And I harvested a bunch of the parts out
of
it. Oh,
yeah, right. We talked about it last time maybe, too.
Yep.
Yeah, and there's a guy in the group named Alan in my group, and he brought in real interesting. Last time he brought his 386 chassis that was real sad looking. He said he kept seeing it like in the corner of his garage. He'd pull in the car, and it was all rusty and sad looking or whatever. And so he decided to take it all apart and take it to an auto place and have it sandblasted and put a auto finish on it.
Seriously.
So it looks brand spanking new now. The entire chassis, the inner chassis,
is
case,
dedication.
I mean, it looks brand new. It's really great. So he's hacking around with that. So I just got me kind of psyched about old PCs. And actually, I just picked up yesterday from a guy. I had to drive out to the Atlanta airport to meet him because he's from Macon. And so I got a Tandy 1000 that's on my dining room table right now. That's kind of fun messing around with.
Yeah, very, you know, cool. Those were kind of maligned back in the day.
Yeah,
right?
A lot,
you
of
know,
all but, Tandy products with the Trash 80 mm-hmm. and all that stuff.
But the Tandy 1000s were actually pretty cool computers for,
yeah,
you know, what they cost and what they did.
Yeah, Radio Shack was an excellent computer dealer. I mean, they're very fair pricing, and their products were good. Their support was good. Yeah, they mm-hmm. just they were all maligned. I don't know why.
I don't know. Well, I think the Model 100, you know, their laptop, notebook computer was always pretty well thought of. But yeah, a lot of their products just, I don't know, they just didn't catch on for some reason.
Yep.
All right,
well,
that brings
us
to you.
Anything else, David?
No, I just saying that brings us to you now.
Oh, my turn? Well, so tomorrow...
You got your fancy Seattle Retro Computing Society.
I'm going again to the Retro Computing Society up in Seattle. The last meeting was awesome, and I'm looking forward to fun again.
It can only
tomorrow.
Go down now.
Yeah, that's right. We got nowhere to go but down. Actually, some folks who couldn't make it last time, I hear, are going to get out to it this time. So, and I'm carpooling up again with Sean, who heads up the Commodore Computer Club, one of the two that we've got here in the Portland metro area. It's up actually in Vancouver, Washington. So we're going to do the carpool thing again and head up and cause trouble.
Isn't that crazy, Carrington? What's in the water over there?
I don't know. No, that's fantastic.
So you have two Commodore clubs.
I know. It's just and the other thing that I have to do, and I gotta do it really quick because time is running out. Man, I always paint myself in a corner on this retro challenge, but
9 days left.
I've got like 9 days, 10 days or something like that to make a virtual drive work for my PX8 laptop. And mm-hmm. You guys, wish me luck or, you know, something. But I gotta do that.
I wish you either luck or hilarious failure.
Yeah,
one of the make two. For a show
but
next time.
Mediocre failure is
no,
just, that's going to be the most boring choice.
Totally.
So.
No middle ground here. Complete success or abject failure involving injury.
But
now one of those two things for the next show.
Putting you on
fire.
The spot, Earl.
Fires.
Is that maybe something you might take with you to the SRCS and, you know, and work on it there, or have anybody look at it, help you out with it, or no?
It's not baked enough yet to do that, but I will say that when it does become so, there's going to be some interest, because I mentioned at the last SRCS meeting that you can still buy these Epson PX8 laptops new in the box. And that got a couple people interested, and one of them went out and bought one and started immediately doing cool stuff with it, like making some custom ROMs for it. And yeah, I was like, wow, this is great.
Wow, holy cow.
So I think there's, you know, going to be a resurgence of interest. And if I could get this virtual drive going, then I don't know how many of those PX8s I've sold for that outfit in Colorado. But, you know, I know it's a lot, because they just started selling them and then they raised their price. Like, thanks a lot. But
Did you get yours cheaper originally?
I did. I got mine for, I can't remember, $75 or $80, and now they're $100, you know.
Yeah.
But
still a good deal.
That's still a good deal for a new in the box.
Yeah, for new in the box, yeah, that's good.
Early 80s laptop. But yeah, so we'll see what happens on that.
I remember when you first mentioned that on Retro Bits.
Yeah, it's fun. And it was even more fun because I actually supported that back in the day when I worked at Epson. So, you know, that was just like, it was like old home week. It was awesome.
Nice.
So you guys, anything else before we put a bow on it?
No,
I'm tired.
Get back to the Kansas Fest Park.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm tired today too for some reason, but I, you know, kind of got amped up on some coffee here before we before we did the show. Caffeine is my friend. So, well, all right then, that's a wrap. Thanks everyone for listening and supporting the show, and of course, please tell a friend or two about it. You can find all the links that we talk about in the show notes. And if you're a fan of the show, we'd ask that you'd please do two things. First, we'd like to hear about it. So you can email us at rcr@classiccomputing.com. Also, help us by rating us. Well, that's if you like us. If you don't like us,
oh, forget
us.
It.
If you like us, go ahead and rate us on iTunes so more people will find us and check us out. And until then, hey, guys, it's been fun as always.
Absolutely.
Good talk to you guys.
And everybody haul out those retro computers and retro computers.